.58.
Okay, on the full speed loaded condition. The upper left-hand corner.
.59 miles.
.59. At full speed in ballast condition. It's lower left-hand.
.61 miles.
Okay. I'd like to state that the reason I went through this is the difference in the advance is from .58 to .61. So is it reasonable to assume that for this particular load and speed conditions that the vessel probably had a 0.6 mile advance?
I would say yes, that's what I was operating on.
Do you have any explanation of if the vessel was outside of the line that you drew there with an advance of 0.6 miles, how you ended up where you are, where the vessel grounded?
I have several thoughts, but they're more speculation on my part. It's a source of trouble for me why vessel did not transfer away from that track line, and I honestly cannot pinpoint the reason.
Okay. With the maneuvering characteristics for the vessel to be on a course that would allow you to see both of those lights off the port side, it would be almost through its turn at that point, is that correct?
Yes, the vessel, yes, it would.
Okay. Could you tell me something about the steering alarm system on this vessel? What kind of steering alarm did it have?
On the steering control unit itself, there are alarms to indicate hydraulic failure, electronic unit failure of called the CPU, pump failure in the steering gear room. We have an additional alarm, steering failure alarm located on the aft bulkhead, partition actually. There are alarms that would indicate whether it's a power failure alarm to the unit or a failure alarm the steering gear pumps.
Where does this alarm ring other than the wheelhouse? Does it also alarm in the engine room?
Yes, it would.
Does the vessel have an off-course alarm? In other words, if the rudder does not match up to the helm, does an alarm sound?
Yes, it does.
Could you explain that alarm?
In terms of when does it respond?
Yes.
As I understand, I don't think that I could give you the specifics of it in terms of how long the rudder would need to be in a certain position or a rudder order would need to be given and the rudder didn't respond, that the alarm would sound. It's different, set differently on different vessels, and I don't recall what it is on this vessel.
Does 12 seconds sound correct? In other words, if the helm is turned to a rudder, say 10 degrees right rudder, if the actual rudder does not match that within 12 seconds, does an alarm sound?
Yes, I had more in mind of 15 seconds, but That may have been from another vessel. I can't.
Okay. So if the rudder does not respond within 15 seconds, 12 to 15 seconds, the alarm would go off?
Correct.
No alarm went off this evening?
No.
Do you know if this alarm was working properly?
I assume that it was. I couldn't say that I'd ever heard the alarm that evening.
Yeah. Isn't that part of the port departure checkoff list?
That would be when we test the gear. The gear test consists of turning the unit on and moving the rudder from the midship to hard right, and then I time from hard right to hard left to ensure that the unit is responding properly. That would be the time that the alarm would sound if there was any defect in it, yes.
Okay. When the vessel's on automatic pilot, is this alarm disengaged or is it still engaged?
It's engaged.
I'd like to refer now to the attachment D, attachment B of the course recording, course recorder study, which is Exhibit 2 Echo. I'd like to look at attachment B and attachment C.
You're listening to gavel-to-gavel coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez, brought to you by KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. We're in the midst now of questioning of the first witness, the third mate, Gregory Cousins. So right now the questioning is being conducted by Commander Darrell Waldron, the Coast Guard's representative here, who seems to be trying to establish that Exxon Shipping's own standard operating procedures weren't followed the night of the wreck.
Right now his line of questioning specifically contains two alarms and is trying to understand why certain alarms, which would tell if the rudder wasn't working properly, did not go off. And even though those alarms should have been engaged, would have gone off even under autopilot conditions. And we have found that, in fact, the ship was under autopilot during part of this this journey.
Early testimony from Greg Cousins, too, tended to indicate that there might have been a problem with the steering, because he noted on at several points that the steering didn't respond as he'd expected it to. Now the question by Commander Waldron seems to eliminate some excuses, at least, along those lines.
It shows a course there of about 220.
Correct.
How would you describe that line between those, that time frame between 0800 and 0830? Is it rough?
How do I interpret?
Commander Waldron has third mate Cousins now examining the paper from the vessel's course recorder and asking him to interpret exactly what that information means.
Was the vessel on automatic pilot?
That would not have been.
I'd like to put your attention to attachment C. This area has been stretched out even further to emphasize changes or variations in the course. Between 0845 Zulu and 0902, which was at the point where you came to right 10 degrees rudder. How would you describe the line there?
This is the first time I've seen this. That's a relative, very straight line.
Very straight line. What would that be indicative of? Hand steering or automatic follow?
Well, I couldn't speculate on that.
So, your experience is hand piloting at 12.3 knots, generally not vary by a quarter of a degree.
Yes, that's reasonable.
Then how would you describe the steering on all the courses on attachment B, where it's hand steering, where most of those were within 1 degree or more?
Would you repeat?
Yeah. Comparing that period of time on attachment C,
yes,
which you described as a fairly straight line, would you compare it with the hand steering on attachment B?
Much smoother line than the earlier hand steering.
Would this indicate that the helmsman on the 8 to 12 or on the midnight to 0400 is a much better helmsman than the steersman on the 20 to 2400?
No, not necessarily.
But in this particular case, he did steer better on hand steering.
It's certainly a straighter line, yes. I believe this is the time that I was off the bridge. I don't know what other commands, if any, were being given up there.
Is it, then it's your firm opinion that between 0850 on attachment, looking at attachment C again, between 0850, say 0852, and the time that you ordered the course change, that was on hand steering or auto steering?
Yes, it was on hand steering. I verified that change when I made the change.
Who actually changed it over from autopilot to hand steering?
I did.
You personally did?
Yes, I did.
Going to the discussions between you and the master again, there's still some areas there that I'm not quite clear on. The instructions given by the master to you concerning where to turn. Was there a range and bearing from any landmark given as a turn point?
As the turn point?
Yes.
Not specified. The directions were, quote, that when we get a beam of Busby, we're going to have to start coming back into the lanes.
And you were a beam of Busby, according to the log, at 2355, is that correct?
Correct.
And when did you start making your turn?
Whatever the elapsed time was between taking the visual bearing, plotting, and that was a minute, maybe. That's an estimate.
Before you started making your turn?
Before I ordered the rudder to 10 right.
The course recorder shows that the turn was made at 0002. It's 7 minutes after the fix was taken.
I see that, yes.
How far will the vessel advance in a matter of 7 minutes at 12.3 knots?
Oh, a mile and three-tenths.
Mile and three-tenths, and what is the advance according to the maneuvering board? The maneuvering characteristics of the vessel was 0.6.
Correct.
So before you could make a turn was at least the 7 minutes plus the 0.6, is that correct? That would be the distance you traveled, almost 2 miles past Busby Island Light?
Yes, correct.
Did you and the master discuss leaving the TSS at all?
Yes, the master informed me that he had communicated with traffic.
Did you feel any need to communicate with the traffic, telling them that where your position was or what you were doing?
Not since the master communicated. My intention was to, of course, inform traffic once we started entering the traffic lanes, yeah.
You've had 12 trips in and out of, is that 12 round trips or 12 one-way trips? 12 round trips?
12 round trips, yeah.
Okay. Have you encountered ice on any of these trips?
Yes, I have.
How many times have you been up on in the wheelhouse in transiting the Bowdy's Arm area?
I didn't hear.
How many of these 12 trips were you on watch during the Valdez Arm transit?
At least half of the time.
Did you encounter ice during any of those six transits?
Occasionally.
Where was this ice located?
Coming out of Columbia Bay, extending out into the traffic lane.
Have you ever had to leave the TSS in order to avoid ice?
Yes.
How many occasions?
Twice that I was present on the bridge.
And who was the master during those departures?
I can't recall exactly.
Was Captain Hazelwood the master during either one of them?
Not at the time that I was on watch and the occurrence took place. I believe it was on another vessel.
When you were on watch during those times, what reports did you give to the VTS concerning leaving the TSS?
We reported our position, our intentions to depart the lane, the reason for departing the lane. Vessel traffic would advise whether we were in fact going to be allowed to depart.
Okay. At the time that the course change was made from 200 to 180, you stated that you saw ice approximately 7 miles ahead on radar. Is that correct?
Yes, that was an estimate I was trying to recall from. Yeah.
Okay. How does ice show up on your radar at 7 miles? Can you determine the size of it, the shape, density?
At a closer range, based on what I had seen in the past, yes, I believe that on a 3-centimeter radar, I got an accurate estimation of the size and extent of the flow of ice.
What kind of estimate of the size would you give, the size of the icebergs, bergy bits, or
I call them small bergs.
Small bergs?
Yes.
Would you consider them as growlers?
There perhaps were growlers, yes. I also saw ice that previous on entering Valdez. So I had some idea of what type of ice that we were going to encounter.
Did you hear any reports from other vessels concerning ice inbound?
No.
Did you have any communications with any of the vessels that were in Valdez concerning the ice?
I didn't personally.
Then what information were you relying on concerning the density and the size of the ice other than your interpretation of the radar at 7 miles?
The fact that when I returned to the bridge that it was obviously some information had been communicated to the master that he deemed that it was necessary to navigate around the ice. Upon further inspection, an assessment of the ice flow based on radar information, I tried visual contact of the ice. It was not possible. Very dark night. My assessment of that was based on prior experience.
Who tried visual contact with the ice?
I did.
You did, after coming up through the wheelhouse?
Yes.
Tell us something about night vision. How long does it take you to get a reasonably good night vision after being in a white light atmosphere?
2 to 5 minutes.
Do you think that's exceptional or is an average?
I have no way of saying one way or the other.
Your lookout also came through the wheelhouse too, is that correct? Up to the bridge?
Yes.
So she would have the same problem with night vision?
Yes, possibly.
Were you on the bridge on 23 March coming in? You had the 8 to 12 watts, so you were
yes.
In that area. Did you transit the Valdez Arms during that watch?
Yes.
What was the ice conditions at that time?
When I came on watch, that was after passing the ice. We'd progressed beyond that, if I remember correctly.
Did the vessel have to maneuver to miss the ice?
I'm going to need to refer to log to recall sometimes.
The question now is whether the ship encountered ice on the inbound trip, and Third Mate Greg Cousins is referring to the log to try to determine whether there was actually a course change made as a result of that. He's being questioned right now by the representative from the U.S. Coast Guard, Commander Darrell Waldron, who seems to be pinning him down very tightly as far as what was actually done and seen. And right now the questions focus on just how serious the threat from ice was, what he was able to see. He's established, or Cousins has responded, that he saw the ice ahead at 7 miles on a 3-centimeter radar, but that he was unable to see it visually.
As I recall, when I relieved the watch, the chief mate told me that they had to maneuver for ice, but I can't recall maneuvering for ice on that watch that evening.
What other trips when you've had to maneuver coming in, Are you generally at a C speed or coming up to C speed, going through ice?
Going through ice?
Right, or going, maneuvering around ice?
Not normally, no.
When you're coming into a port where you have to make, you're expected to make course changes, what is your normal speed for maneuvering around, for making course changes?
Upon making arrival at a port, prior to picking up the pilot, we would have gone to a maneuvering speed. It's on the recommendation of the pilot, or the pilot may request that we do see speed, you know, if it's acceptable to the captain on a inbound or an outbound transit. But why, normally we're on maneuvering speed in a port or harbor area.
Why would you con the vessel at a maneuvering speed or a slower speed than sea speed when you're expecting to be doing maneuvers? What would be the advantage of doing that?
At a slower speed?
Right.
Well, based on the confines of a harbor situation, you need to have more adequate control of your vessel. If you need to stop in a hurry with excessive weigh on the ship, you're not going to be able to do that.
What would you define as a confine of a harbor? What distance?
What distance?
Right.
It could be, I would say, any harbor area.
5 miles width, 2 miles width?
Five. It could be five in some harbors. It could be even greater in some harbors.
According to your testimony earlier, you stated that you estimated only 0.9 miles between the ice and Bligh Reef. Is 0.9 miles what you would consider a confining area?
Yes, I would.
Did it seem odd that you would be going up to sea speed during an area that you're going to be going through a confined area?
Considering the maneuvering characteristics of the vessel, I also understand that decreased speed makes it less maneuverable.
Decreased below what speed?
It's more, your turning circle is certainly going to be smaller with increased speed than if you're advancing at 5 or 6 knots. And what was it, in my view, and as the captain explained to me, what we needed to do was have a sufficient amount of maneuverability to get around the ice.
What is maneuvering speed then? Does that give you sufficient maneuverability at maneuvering speed?
Sufficient in terms of what we were attempting?
In terms of maneuvering in a confined space?
In certain circumstances, it wouldn't be a blanket statement, you know, that it would apply in all circumstances, that would be adequate.
As I would define it, or as I think it has been defined, that the reason for going slow is not necessarily to be able to maneuver better or less, but to have more time in order to make decisions. Going at 12 knots, you cover a lot of ground within just a few minutes in a confined space. in 0.9 miles, you would cover that in less than 5 minutes for a 1 mile duration.
Commander, do you have a question?
Yes.
Or is that a statement you're making?
Do you agree with the reason for going maneuvering speed versus sea speed as being able to allow more time for making navigation decisions, taking fixes, et cetera?
Could you restate the question, please?
Just the question.
Okay, going at a slower speed versus a faster speed allows you more time to make navigation decisions. Do you agree with that?
I would agree.
What was the weather from Busby Island to the grounding? We've heard some vague generalities of it. It was somewhat clear. Could you tell me what you remember the weather being, the weather conditions, the visibility conditions? Anybody else have anything else? What was the weather from Busby Island to the grounding? We've heard some vague generalities of it. It was somewhat clear. Could you tell me what you remember the weather being, the weather conditions, the visibility conditions?
It was a extremely dark night. Absolutely no light. It was overcast. I noticed a light mist in the air. I estimated the visibility based on lights that I was looking at to be 5 to 6 miles.
What about the transit through the Narrows? What was the visibility like then? Was it basically the same?
Yes, as I recall.
Do you have an estimate of how much headway the vessel made from the first contact until it came to a stop?
I have an estimate of perhaps 600 to 700 feet.
Did the vessel tend to veer at all when contact was made, or was it pretty much still making the smooth turn?
In the initial contact, yes, it did list slightly or take a lean to port.
Is that normal when you're making a starboard turn to have a...
No.
Do you have any idea what time the Exxon Valdez crossed out of the outbound lane into the inbound lane and then out of the inbound lane?
Not precisely. It was during the time that I was having a conversation with the captain.
And there were no other fixes taken between the time in the middle of the TSS until you were abeam of Busby Island Light?
That's correct.
In the logbook, you have a symbol for being a beam of Busby Island Light. How do you normally log such an occurrence?
That way.
With a line and a...
Yes.
Through a zero. If you were a beam, if it was a beam to port, how would that be written? How would you describe? Does the arrow point from left to right or right to left?
It would be pointing to the left.
To the left?
Yeah.
Would you look on the log and describe how that is logged?
What exhibit and what page?
I need the...
4 Bravo.
Do you have this other?
Yeah, I do.
We are still listening to questioning from Coast Guard Commander Darrell Waldron, who seems to be attempting to establish actually a pattern of inexperience on the part of Third Mate Greg Cousins and a pattern of small errors.
When the vessel was aground, which side was Busby Island Light on at that time?
And that it was astern of us. And our initial contact?
No, after the vessel was aground and the final grounding, final resting on the reef.
On the starboard side.
On the starboard side. Was there a discussion by you and the master of Mount making a turn back towards the TSS at a 38-fathom mark?
No.
Did he indicate a point on the chart other than you stated earlier that you looked at the radar and had a discussion on where to turn? Did you look at the chart also and discuss a point of turning?
No.
There's still some points about the automatic pilot that I'm not quite sure on. Would you just, this is the last question. Would you go through that sequence of events from the time that the master directed, or that you believe that the master directed the automatic pilot to be placed on to the time of the grounding, please?
You want my actions?
Yes, I want your description of the activities involved with the automatic pilot from the time that it was put on by the captain or requested to be put on by the captain to the grounding, the sequence of events.
But you just want to find out what he saw or did as
yes.
the gyro.
Right,
period.
The sequence of events,
we're not
yes.
going to repeat everything he's done
no.
for the last 3 or 4 hours.
Mr. Richard,
no.
What's the question, Commander?
What was the sequence of event that Mr. Cousins was involved with with respect to the automatic pilot from the time that it was put on 180 until the time of the grounding?
Mr. Cousins' activities. You mean Mr. Cousins' activities during that?
Yes, period? Only Mr. Cousins' activities, right.
My
what you saw and heard in relation to it.
Okay, the first indication that that we were on gyro was at the change of the watch. After the change of the watch and the master was departing the bridge for his office, I told the AB that we're going to put it in hand steering. At that time, I shifted modes from the gyro mode to helm mode, which is hand steering.
Do you have any idea of the times involved there?
Estimate, yes. It's just prior to the 23:55 fix.
Thank you, Mr. Cousins. I appreciate you answering all those questions. I'm sorry it took so long.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Commander. Dr. LaRiche?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hello, Mr. Cousins. We're glad to have you back up here. I don't envy what you've been doing the last 3 hours here. I have just a few questions, which hopefully will clarify some of the other things that you've been asked. I'd refer you to page 4 of Exhibit 4, Oscar, which is the exhibit you already have.
The questioning has just been shifted over from Coast Guard Commander Darrell Waldron to the State of Alaska's Representative Bob LaResch.
Whatever it's characterized as. This is the officer's signature sheet. Now, your signature appears here 3 times, Mr. Cousins, correct me if I'm wrong, on 8-12-87, 3-something-88, and the 2nd of February of 1989. And you certified by signing off on this thing that you've read and understood the contents of this manual. And it says above, you're directed by the company to sign this as soon as practical after joining the vessel. Do you recall signing these 3 times? Was each of these times, was this manual aboard the Exxon Valdez?
Yes.
So you served as an officer on her as far back as 87?
Correct.
Okay. Had you in fact read and understood this big thick manual at the time you signed these?
Yes. Not the first time that I read that manual.
Okay. Why'd you bother to read it again when you signed this? I mean, didn't you know it was in it anyway?
That's company policy. Also, it's good to refresh your memory.
What would have happened had you just signed it without reading it?
I think, he's going to be asked to speculate as to what might happen. He told the questioner he read it all 3 times, so he should be speculating as to what might happen if he didn't read it.
Mr. Cousins, is the question, Dr. LaResch, is there a company policy about reading before signing? Is that your question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. More specifically, would the company have ever paid any attention whether he read the thing or not?
Well, Dr. LaResch, I don't know if Mr. Cousins can answer that question. If the question is, is Mr. Cousins aware of what the company's policy is on reading before signing, I think Mr. Cousins can answer that question. Your subsequent question, he is not qualified to answer.
Okay. So you are aware of the company's policy that you should read this before signing it, and every one of these times you did that?
Yes.
Okay, in answering previous question, you said that you did not know about the zero grounding or the shoals policy included in this manual at the time of the accident.
No, I did not say that.
I believe you did, sir. Okay. You said that you learned that policy subsequent to the accident.
There's some misunderstanding there.
Okay. Thank you. Now, I'm a little unclear as to your previous experience at the con of the Exxon Valdez and similar vessels. You said this was your 3rd trip into Prince William Sound on the Exxon Valdez. Is that correct?
No, I said that was my 3rd assignment aboard the Exxon Valdez. I would have had more time in Prince William Sound on the Valdez than just 3 transits.
I still don't understand. How many transits did you made of Prince William Sound aboard the Exxon Valdez as a deck officer?
Approximately 4 round trips.
Approximately 4. And on other Exxon vessels in the Sound?
Yes.
More than that?
Yeah. Yes.
As many as 10, maybe, or?
Perhaps.
Okay, perhaps around 10.
I mean, I don't have that information. What I would need to give you an absolute answer on that is that I would really need my personal log, which I don't have with me.
Mr. Cousins, can you provide that to the board?
I could at some date.
Not today. I mean,
yes.
At some future date.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, and In these previous transits, either on the Exxon Valdez or other vessels, had you ever been left alone at the con inside Hinchinbrook previous to this incident?
For short periods of time.
For short periods of time. With whom as master, do you recall?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I would have to refer back to my records.
Okay, but as far as you recall, this had happened previously on Exxon vessels in Prince William Sound.
Yes.
And that was, as you well knew, you'd read the policy book so many times, that was clearly contrary to the policy.
It was contrary to the policy to be inside Hinchinbrook Island at any time. In what fashion? Why don't you point us out?
With Mr. Cousins at the con of the vessel with his endorsements.
Mr. Richmond? Mr. Cousins, can you answer the question?
If he'd restated, I would.
Okay, you were led through the policy regarding who had to be in charge of the vessel, who had to be at the con within Prince William Sound area, the area that requires a pilotage endorsement. And I believe your answer was that you had been at the con of an Exxon vessel previous to this inside Prince William Sound.
Correct.
For short periods of time.
Yes.
And you did, of course, on that on those occasions, breached the company policy. Were you ever reprimanded for taking the con in the waters where the policy was opposed to that?
No.
Okay, thank you. You do not have, as I understand it, pilotage endorsement for Prince William Sound.
No, I do not.
Is that a difficult endorsement to attain?
I don't know that it is. I haven't inquired about that.
Did the company ever encourage you to get such an endorsement?
That's typically something they would ask of their masters and not a third mate.
So they typically would have only one officer on board with such an endorsement?
Typically, yes.
Okay. Let's refer briefly to the maneuvering characteristics chart again, if you will. It's 3I.
Dr. LaRiche, I think that's 3 Juliet.
I'm sorry, sir?
I think that's 3 Juliet.
Oh, okay. We have it mislabeled. On this chart, it shows turning radius and advances, as you've discussed fully before, at two different speeds and two different loadings. What's the rudder setting in each of these 8 examples?
That's hard right rudders and hard left rudders.
Would you expect the either the advance or the transfer or the turning radius to vary if a ship is turned with 10 degrees rudder or 20 degrees rudder?
Absolutely.
Okay. Would you?
I couldn't address that. That's be speculating.
Okay. Yeah, I understand.
I don't care to do that.
Did you consider using greater rudder when you were in this place that you have already acknowledged made you feel confined?
I did, in fact, use greater rudder.
You did, eventually. Let me refer us to the Exhibit 4 Delta, the blow up of the course recorder again. That'd be attachment C.
The state's representative, Bob Laresh, is now back on questions having to do with the maneuvering characteristics of the vessel, and specifically seems to be trying to establish, as did Coast Guard Commander Waldron, that not enough time was allowed for the kind of maneuvering that Captain Hazelwood had ordered his third mate to do, namely to get back into the standard tanker lanes by the time that Busby Island was amidships or right alongside of the tanker.
In addition, Laresh has established that Cousins read a manual which says very clearly that he was not qualified to navigate in Prince William Sound.
0855 on this chart, being Zulu time. The previous questioner asked you a lot about whether when you shut off the gyro, and I believe you said it was about 2355.
Slightly before that, before I took the fix, it shifted from gyro to hand steering.
Okay, that makes sense. Was Mr. Kagan a very good helmsman? Was Mr. Kagan, who was at the helm at this time, was he a good helmsman in your mind?
I really had no specific knowledge since Kagan was not on my watch. I had never had him as a watchstander before.
This was the first time you had stood watch with this particular helmsman?
It's the first time I'd ever had him on my watch, yes.
Okay. All right. So, at any rate, from this line, he was pretty good. Now, how long does it take after giving this vessel 10 degrees right rudder until a course change can be observed?
I would expect that nothing like this would be representative of a 10 degree rudder command. It shows absolutely no heading change at all. I would expect it to get some reaction within a minute of that or so of the rudder getting to 10 right.
Okay. Would you agree with Ed Murphy, the pilot, who says this ship swings 10 degrees in the first 20 seconds? Of a rudder command.
Where does Ed Murphy say that? We haven't been presented with that.
Mr. Richards, would ask your question, Dr. Reich,
okay,
without bringing in the pilot.
Okay. Let me ask it again, then. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I think you've already answered it, Mr. Cousins, but how long after putting in 10 degrees rudder can you see a course change on this recording? How soon after putting in that rudder?
From, based on the recorder.
How quickly does the ship respond to a rudder change?
Would I expect it to?
Yes.
Within a minute of it getting
okay.
To the.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Order.
Now, in our review of this chart, to. Tell me if you agree with this interpretation, please, sir. It looks as though you had a certain rate of turn for about 1.5 minutes indicating your 10 degree rudder. I believe you said earlier that you thought you left it on 10 degrees for about 1.5 minutes.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. And then we see a greater angle of turn for approximately 4 minutes. And after about 2.5 minutes, you see something that looks as though someone's trying to check the swing of this vessel.
You're referring to just slightly after.
After 0905 on the chart.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you tell Mr. Kagan to come to a bearing? Course heading?
No,
you did not. Is the only conversation you had with Mr. Kagan how many degrees of rhetoric to put in at any given time?
Yes.
Would you have expected a helmsman to gratuitously check the swing of the vessel in this situation?
No, I wouldn't.
So you did not imply or tell Mr. Kagan to come to a specific course?
No, I did not.
Thank you, sir. Let's go back to your description of what Captain Hazelwood, what his exact instructions were to you. I believe you've had to say two or three times this morning that he told you something to the effect that when we get a beam of Busby, we're going to have to start faring back into the lanes.
Correct.
Okay. Did he tell you an exact course to follow to fare back into those lanes?
No, he did not.
Did he plot anything on a chart?
No.
Okay. Okay, now, you also have told us, I believe, that Captain Hazelwood told you to skirt the edge of this ice.
Yes.
Given where you've drawn the ice on that chart, given where you were a beam of Busby, was there any way to comply with both of those orders? Seems to me that starting the turn a beam of Busby would have run you into the ice.
Correct.
Did this cause you concern that you had two contradictory orders, or did the second one supersede the first?
I think that perhaps the master wasn't aware of how far it the ice, when I say it, the ice extended through the northbound lane. But given our position, I knew that we were going to have to start initiating some maneuver to come back to the lanes. When I talked to him, I told him I think that there's a chance that we may get into, you know, the edge of this ice.
And when you spoke to him on the phone, I suppose a little after 2355?
Yes.
When you spoke to him and you said there's a chance we're going to have to get into the ice, what did he say more precisely than asking you if the second was up there?
That's the extent of the conversation. I informed him that it looks like there is a possibility that we may get into the very edge of the ice flow. And he said, okay, ask me, of course, about the second mate, and then responded that he would be up in a few minutes.
Okay, so, well, if I take it at face value, that's all he said. I mean, he didn't ask, he didn't tell you to come to a certain course. He didn't tell you to not hit any ice. He didn't tell you to slow down. He didn't ask you if you were still comfortable with the situation.
No.
Thank you. You said earlier, I believe, that Captain Hazelwood had gone down below to transmit some messages. Is what the impression you had?
Yes.
He said that?
Yes, he said he needed to get some messages out, that he would be in his office and would return shortly.
Do you have any idea what messages an officer would have to get out at this point of
approach? He may have needed to communicate certain figures that the agent may not have collected while on board, messages to the office, that type of thing.
How would he have done that from his office?
He writes them up on the forms and would more than likely ask the radio operator to send them, or he would, the information for Alomar, he could relay from the bridge or from the Marisat.
Okay. Thank you. Had you ever met Bob Kagan before this voyage?
One other time. As a matter of fact, in the previous, my previous assignment, he was assigned as, I believe, excuse me, a maintenance seaman, I believe.
Did you have any personal relationship with him or knowledge of him?
Not really. I worked with him briefly here during the tank cleaning. He was down there cleaning tanks, but I don't never had him working directly for me.
Okay. You said earlier that at your command of hard left after you had felt the initial grounding.
No,
there seemed to be
incorrect. Not after, before.
You gave a hard left command before the grounding?
Pardon me, I didn't hear. I thought you said I thought you said hard right.
No, okay. Let's you gave, as we all understand, a hard right before the grounding.